So hello and welcome everyone to who's ever listening to this particular podcast on YouTube, Apple, Google, Spotify or any other platforms. I am Jayesha. I'm a PhD student at Arizona State University and I invite machine learning engineers, researchers, entrepreneurs and professors to talk more about their current work, insights about their journey and getting started with it. And for this particular podcast, I have with me Ishan Mishra, who is a research scientist at Facebook AI Research. Much of his current research work revolves around the lines of supervised and self-supervised learning. And he's very well known for his few recent works that got published that are named Swarm and Pearl. He completed his PhD from Carnegie Mellon University with Marshall Herbert and Abhinav Gupta. And his PhD thesis was titled Visual Learning with Minimal Human Supervision. So thanks a lot for being over here, Ishan, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Jay. Thank you.
Right. So you have been involved a lot along the lines of machine learning and computer vision as a whole. So before we get started into your particular research topic, that is self-supervised learning, can you talk to us, like, what was your interest point in AI? How did you get started with it? And what was the inception point for you?
Right. So I think it started around in my undergrad. And when I was doing my undergrad in computer science, AI was not, it was hot, but it wasn't that hot at that point. Like the field that actually everyone was really talking about was cloud computing. So I remember like the cloud computing, like courses that we took had like hundreds of students and everyone wanted to learn Hadoop. And, you know, MapReduce was the thing that had come out. So I was really interested in like cloud computing and parallel programming, like from an operating systems perspective. And so my undergrad advisor actually worked on like GPU parallel programming. And so we got started on a project, and images and like graphics in general has a lot of need for high process, like parallel computing. And you have like embarrassingly parallel problems there because each pixel can you can possibly work independently. So I got started on that. And from images, basically there, I was like, huh, this is actually pretty interesting. You can do very interesting things with it. And then I took a machine learning course and computer vision. And then basically that's how it got started.
Right. And I guess if I'm correct me if I'm wrong, like you started around 2012. So that I guess that was kind of the time when ImageNet moment came in. So I guess it's fair enough to say that most of the people won't be interested in machine learning prior to 2012. So I guess 2012 might be itself a year that you might have introduced yourself to recent hype in machine learning. Right.
Right. I mean, in particular, actually, I didn't get started with deep learning until like a couple of years later, because even in 2012 when I started, or like even in my undergrad, we were still working with like SIFT and HOG and all of these kinds of things with SVMs. And it was only after a couple of years into my PhD that I actually started really looking at deep learning.
Right, right. So can you tell us a bit about your current role as a research scientist? What kind of projects do you work at FAIR right now? And what are the past projects versus the current projects that you have worked in the last, 3 years?
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, like you mentioned earlier, like most of my research is all about like reducing the need for supervision. That's something I did in my PhD as well. And that's kind of the theme on which I work even now. So I would say like my past projects have been about representation learning, and representation learning specifically focused on images and a little bit on video. And more recently, I've been exploring on like how you can either like explore the limitations of this representation learning, either by looking at whether they work on real world data. So like in the wild images, uncurated images at scale, whether all of these methods can actually work on different types of data. So whether they can work on video and like audio, or whether they can work on completely like, unstructured data or like set-based data like point clouds or 3D data. So that's sort of the three axes along which I'm really working on right now. The goal is to understand representation learning more and more, having sort of getting some insights from image-based self-supervised learning.
Right. And so talking about more about self-supervised learning, and that is one thing, as I was mentioning, it is something that I have been also in the past couple of months, I have been learning a lot for my own projects. And you recently co-authored a very nice article with Yann LeCun about self-supervised learning. So In terms of an overall perspective of the idea or the motivation behind self-supervised learning, how do you think that the article itself talks a lot about a step towards common sense, right? Like we see supervised learning has done great things, but at the end, we are not able to generalize these across different modalities of data or different types of tasks that we do. So how do you think in an overall perspective that self-supervised learning is maybe a step towards building much more generalizable AI models or make sure that these models are learning what we say common sense?
Right. So I think one way to think about it is that supervised learning really couples together two types of problems. It couples together representation learning, which is basically how do I represent my input? What sort of interesting structures does my input have? So if you talk about pixels, it's like, okay, can I understand that these pixels, belong to the same object? Oh, and these two objects are actually related, or this object is in front of the other object, and so on. So these kind of pixel-based relations, it couples this kind of representation learning with the end task, which can be something like, identifying the classes in ImageNet or detecting a particular object in COCO. So when you're doing like this kind of supervised learning, you're actually coupling together both of these things. And essentially your model or whatever you learn, the knowledge is really capped by this kind of a signal that you're predicting at the end. Your task is about recognizing 1,000 classes. So yes, you are going to learn features which are going to be about recognizing these 1,000 classes. So, well, I mean, the model is not at fault. We asked it to recognize 1,000 classes and then we are like, oh, you don't generalize. But why should the model generalize? So I think if you think about it this way, then it kind of makes sense that self-supervised learning is probably like a better alternative to this, because you are not really asking it to predict or do a particular task. You're not asking it to just recognize 1,000 classes or like distinguish between these different breeds of a dog. You are likely to discover more sort of generalizable concepts or more generalizable things, which actually help you across a variety of domains, across different data sets, and across different tasks. So that's the sort of reason I really do believe that this kind of representation learning is more powerful and is probably going to, help us in the longer term.
Right. So when you talk about can it be translated to saying that you are trying to lease out the kind of limitations that you have for learning the feature representation versus classes and features? So are you trying to lease out those, loosen out those constraints on model and let it discover itself? Is that something along the lines of self-supervised learning, or in itself it refers to some kind of other technique?
Right. I think that's one way of looking at it, that because you're decoupling like this entire like the end task that you care about and the representation learning part, possibly the representations that you learn or you discover are going to be more generalizable than basically what you would if you had just a particular task or a particular set of tasks in mind. So that's one way of viewing it, because you are not really, you're not just beholden to the exact like downstream task. You are likely to learn features that are going to be better.
And in this case, for example, if you have these kind of models, how do you typically evaluate the kind of learnings that the model does? Like for the standard supervised learning, we have these attention maps or saliency maps that allows us to see where the model is looking. And I agree that this is kind of a much more restricted learning, right? Like we are just, like you said, we are just restricted to 1,000 features and that's what we are making it do. But at the end, we kind of have a method to check where the model is looking at versus if it is looking at something totally random that is not part of the explainability umbrella. In self-supervised learning, would that be an issue? Like, how do I make sure the model is learning something that's maybe making sense to model itself or maybe to humans? How do we check that?
So I haven't personally worked a lot on the explainability part. Even in supervised learning, I generally worked on representations, sort of analyze them. But my sort of most of my research is actually about like empirical evaluations in terms of like numerical results rather than like interpretability. So one sort of good way of looking at it or like at least in a limited sort of scope understanding whether your model is doing well is to see how it performs on different image domains. So suppose you learn from something like ImageNet. ImageNet has like these nicely centered images belonging to 1,000 sets of classes. What happens when you learn features from this and you now go to a completely different image distribution, say cartoon classification? You have images of cartoons, which are nothing like what ImageNet has. Now, can you actually perform this task well? This is another sort of way of testing generalization, right? If I show you, say, a picture of an elephant, like a real elephant, you should be able to recognize a cartoon elephant and vice versa. Like kids, when they grow up learning, they actually look at like cartoon books. You know, this is an elephant. And then when they go to a zoo, yes, they can kind of relate, or someone points it out and they are able to figure out what an elephant is. So this is one way of checking whether your model has actually learned something. It's more numerical. Yes, I can't point out to specific instances or specific like heat maps, attention maps to figure out what it is focusing on. But in aggregate, it gives you a sense of whether this model has done or learned anything. So it won't give you like for this particular image, what it has learned or what feature it has picked on. But in aggregate, is it able to generalize across these two domains? And then you kind of get a sense of how well it's doing that.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So in that case, I guess that makes sense that you have to rely on numerical values versus like saying a supervised algorithm did X percent of performance on this data set, and self-supervised learning would be maybe outperforming or maybe doing on a similar scale. Okay.
Right. Then there's, of course, another way of doing it, which is basically, I would say, moving more towards like, you know, slightly more interpretable way of doing things, is to look at the embeddings that a self-supervised model produces for a particular instance, so an image or a video. And then looking at, like in the feature space, what are its nearest neighbors? So what are the things that this model thinks should be basically close by in its feature space? And you can basically compare that to what a supervised model would do. So in that sense, you kind of figure out, okay, if it turns out that your image had like three concepts, A, B, and C, and when you compute the nearest neighbors, all the nearest neighbors only contain concept A, and they don't contain concepts B and C. So you can like basically say that, okay, it turns out that of these three concepts, it's really focusing on concept A, and it's kind of ignoring concepts B and C. And now if that's not desirable to you, then basically that's something that we should try to fix. But I don't think we have like such a general answer that, oh, if it's B and C, then I need to fix this particular thing in training.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And one of your other works that I was looking at before prepping for this podcast was along the lines of Perl, where you have these explanations of pretext task versus the task on the, what I don't know the exact word, but it's along the lines where you have the labeled data set, right? So right. You do your pretext training versus the BART, where you do your fine tuning or maybe the actual training on the labeled task. So in those cases, do we need to have a kind of a correlation between these two data sets that we do? For example, like you said, if I do the pretext task on natural images of elephants versus the labeled task is just of cartoons of elephants, would it make sense theoretically to do such a task and then evaluate results before we even jump to the results, even if it's good or bad? But does that make sense? Does that have to be a correlation between these two tasks in terms of data sets?
Yeah, so it's a loaded question, right? So there are two, I would say there are two separate answers. One is a practitioner's answer, which is like, okay, if this is what you had to do and this is what, like, you know, you have to solve this problem for whatever to get a good grade or to build your new next company, versus the theoretician's answer or like the kind of, you know, longer term answer, what we really want our AI systems to be capable of. So let's go like with the first, like the practitioner's answer. The practitioner's answer is probably no, right? Because if you want to recognize cartoon elephants, just like, you know, if that's the problem you really care about, then just throw like data at it and like really try to figure out the right modeling, the right data, and like exactly the right metrics that you care about for that task. So in this case, possibly like pre-training on natural image elephants and then going to cartoon image elephants is probably not going to be that good for you. But okay, now coming to the second part, which is like where we want the systems to go. Ideally, we would want this system to kind of work well, right? So I think the question is not really about is it the best system for cartoon elephant classification? The question should be more about, given these cartoon elephants, can my system generate a reasonable answer? So even in humans, right, there are people who are better at recognizing different species of birds, right? They're trained to do this. They like spend years and years studying birds, versus if you give it to someone like me, I have no idea. So of course, someone like, and if you want to classify birds, then basically there are, you know, people who are specialized for it, and then there are people who can't do it really well. But right. Even like to most humans, if you give them a picture of a bird and you give them a picture of an elephant, they can tell you that these are two different things. And you can change like the lighting, you can change the type of the bird. They can tell you these are two different things. So I would say this is more like more generic image understanding or more generic sort of understanding. So yes, I think we would want our AI system to do this. And current systems are showing more and more sort of, they are on this kind of trajectory that they are becoming more and more robust to, you know, the pre-training data that they were trained on and the fine-tuning data that you have. But we still have a long way to go.
Right. So let me tell you a base for that particular question. For example, the way I... a kind of a stereotype in computer vision, like you said, a word, right? Like we throw more data over the model and it will do those things. But often then more often, like in the pure computer vision community, we can artificially generate data or maybe just collect from the internet or somewhere over there. But for example, the data sets for example, that one I'm working on for imaging data sets, medical imaging data sets, what happens is we have patients and they have these long studies. And they have 6 months enrollment and 18 months enrollment. So at the end, the best case scenario that they are happy about is having 100 samples or maybe even less than that. So having a 60 samples is kind of a big deal for the study from a medical standpoint. But from a computer vision or algorithmic perspective for doing any kind of even very fine-tuned task, that is not even like the model doesn't even wake up by using 45 samples. So right. My basis for that is, for example, a lot of paper gets published along the lines of, let's say, Alzheimer's and other detection studies, where they have these very minute anomalies in the brain that really classifies person to be Alzheimer's versus normal patients. And the idea is over other diseases like headaches and all those migraines and all those studies where they don't even know where the model should be looking at. For example, you can validate, right? Like if you want to classify an elephant, you have an understanding even when you look at the edges that the model would detect, then you as a human can verify if the model is garbage, itself or doing something. That was the pretext for that question that can we do, for example, if I have a data set that is very well trained on Alzheimer's data set for which I have 1,000 samples. On the other hand, pick up another migraine study where I just have 45 samples. Can I use Alzheimer's data set pre-training as a pretext task where it does the classification, it does those things. Now over here I have a migraine study. I don't know where the model should be looking at. I just want this black boxy model to do its beauty but just at the end make sure that it is not doing something random, because we are relying solely on the black box model, right, to make the classifications. So right. Would it be possible, like over here we are essentially doing different tasks in it first, and the modalities are the same but the tasks are different, but the task is quite unknown, and hence, like, just imagine like an alien where you have, like, you didn't even know that there is a different species of elephant, but you still want the black box model to detect that elephant. So certain kind of scenario,
yeah. Right. I mean, I think it's harder to say this a priori, but I mean, I think there are natural limitations, not just to like even like our models but also to us, right? So if you were to show someone who's never seen an elephant for the first time, I'm sure they would be surprised and confused, like, what is this? And what is it supposed to be? And this happens a lot. So, I mean, of course, the correlation matters, like what you want the model to do and what it has already seen. So, if it's closer, then the model is expected to do better.
Yeah.
But yeah, the trajectory is to basically move more towards, like, if you think about distributions, if the distributions are non-overlapping, you want this model to be able to generalize. But yes, I mean, I think even humans don't generalize completely perfectly. So I think it's still a long way to go in understanding how we generalize, what the limits of our own generalization are, and then, you know, try to see, okay, can we build machines which are either as capable or as us, or have different capabilities as us, or are like better capabilities than us.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I mean, sorry for throwing out an open research question. I was just curious, like just trying to learn along those, because that pretext task really hit hard. Like that was really nice concept that if you incorporate that feeling, it's kind of different than typical transfer learning that we do. So it's a really nice way of doing it. Yeah. But talking about small data sets, in your experience, the papers that I read from your profile, most of them didn't have a problem with these small data sets. But if you had a chance, in your experience, like if you were to work with a very specific curated small data sets, and this might not be related to your domain of research, but what do you think are the kind of most promising learning methods if you have just 100 samples that you want the model to be specialized on? And of course, the world of data sets is there, like you have imaginate models. Would you go along the lines of transfer learning versus, I have heard few papers on active learning versus few shot learning. Which learning methods, in your experience, if you have done like for some literature survey or something like that, which methods you see have the potential in the next few years to really scale? There are obvious limitations that we can go on and on for maybe like 2 hours, but right. In terms of a trade-off between which has the least amount of disadvantages, what do you think is a good method?
I mean, depending on the downstream task, if pre-training is working even reasonably, if like then it's always good to start with, you know, a pre-trained model because, well, you have a better shot at doing things and improving it. Active learning, I think, then would be the next thing I would go for, just because, if you have just 100 samples, you are really limited by those 100 samples. And if it is a problem that you really care about solving, then possibly you want to acquire more labeled data for it, or at least some kind of, it may not be strong supervision. It might be just, you know, like try to pseudo label a bunch of samples and then try to see which ones are actually good, which ones are bad. But pseudo labeling being one and active learning being one, sort of these two would be the things that I would go for.
Right. And like, is there a specific reason for those selections, or is it like, why do you believe in those methods more than, well, let's say few shot learning? Why would you?
Like, right. So, I mean, few shot learning by itself is just a problem specification, right? It's not a methodology. It's just a problem specification that you have few labeled examples and you want basically, that's it. And of course, you want to perform as well as possible, but it doesn't describe how you will do this. So pseudo labeling just seems to work really well. I mean, there are lots of like papers from Google, so like a noisy student paper, lots of papers from Facebook on speech recognition, which do really well on using pseudo labeling. So that's just like empirical evidence because I've seen so many people do it and like have like really good results. And active learning, active learning is sort of the more natural way of doing it, right? So you, of course, getting more labels generally seems to improve performance. So of course, that would be the other practitioner's viewpoint there.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And if I were to just try to zoom back and maybe one thing that you mentioned is, at the end, these concepts like comparing the performance of a model, we talk about human level intelligence versus artificial intelligence. Is there a common trend when we try to come up with new methods and solving a new task to see how humans do it? For example, a lot of if we see a lot of these new techniques and models like GANs and convolutional neural networks in itself, they have kind of a mapping to how humans work, right? Like if you see GANs, discriminator versus generator, the idea in itself in the very core, it feels like it has been inspired from how humans learn, right? Like we talk about, right, we compare, like if you show a child and a photo of cat, he just needs one photo, but model requires millions of that. So is there a trend to see or maybe inspire from human way of thinking, or is it purely empirical, like you say? Like, do we try to come up with solutions based on purely mathematical knowledge or computer science knowledge, or is it, does there still exist a lot amount of like going back to the social way of how humans adapt and how humans learn?
I would say it's like a very personal choice for a lot of people. So, you can always draw inspiration from how the brain works, but we also don't understand how the brain works really well and what human capabilities are. So that's in itself, like people are spending a lot of effort trying to understand that. So as our understanding in that grows, that sort of influences what we do. So yes, neural networks were inspired by how like neurons are organized, but the way that we are actually doing it now, like, all the kinds of models we have now, I would say, are not exactly the way like neural circuitry is in most beings. So there is some amount of difference there. I think more than figuring out how humans do it. Maybe a better way, like for me personally, is what humans do or what they're capable of. That at least sort of tends to inspire me a lot more. So something like few short learning, right? Humans are capable of it. So yes, it's possible. And now, will the model do it in the same way that a human does? Maybe not. But this is an ability that seems to be generally useful. And there is like evidence that it is possible. And there is a biological system that can do it. So maybe it's an ability that actually can be added to a computational system as well. So I think taking such inspiration actually helps a little bit more like when I think of things, because one, I necessarily don't understand how the brain works. So even if like folks publish it really well, like present it really well, I may not be able to translate it into what I do. So that's like the sort of simple reason. And the second reason is also that maybe that is not directly translatable into like what you have when you're actually writing these models. So capabilities generally tend to help a lot more.
Yeah, it's more like you would focus more on how what humans can do versus how they can do it, because inherently the way humans process, which is still unknown how we derive to a decision, versus definitely computers are much more empirical. We know what is the computations and what are the mathematical functions that lead you to that.
So, right. I mean, the other way I think about it is really like anecdotal. And this is one of my favorite stories, is how we discovered flight, right? The ability to fly. Well, I mean, lots of folks saw birds flapping around. Maybe that's like the thing to do. So if you just like look at it pure mechanistic way, just create, you know, flaps and flap it out, and then basically we should be able to fly. But it turns out that's not the way the things happen, right? So we figured out maybe later, maybe earlier, what aerodynamics are, and then flapping is one way of doing it, but there are other ways of achieving it as well. And so the reason we got to the moon is basically not by flapping winds around. We got it in a very different way. So yes, the point is that you're inspired by the ability, and maybe mechanisms to achieve it are different, and they can be different just because fundamentally like certain things are easier in certain systems than they are in others.
Right. Yeah. This actually, like you said, the idea of flight, because until recently, and this is very, very embarrassing on my part, was like maybe just 1 year back, I realized, not maybe 1 year, but maybe 2 years back only, I realized that the way we think of neural net, I always used to think that neurons in itself are complete way of how human neurons are, like what neurons we see in computers, because I thought that it would have something different definitions, but it is much more of an incomplete of how human neurons work. So that is just maybe 1% of how biological neurons work that was maybe inspired and taken into computers. So I later realized, I thought that was the complete definition. Okay, of course activation functions won't be there, but there will be something similar, but that there goes a lot more than that. So yeah, the flight example makes sense. So this brings me to a different question, slightly on a different tangent, but on a similar note, is you have been working with a lot of researchers which are very well known in the computer vision community itself, and maybe more than that. What is the typical motivation for any kind of novel research that they do? Like, for example, if you are working with some professor and the idea comes out that you are supposed to work on, or maybe if you come up with an idea of solving a particular task, is it application oriented, or is it like a pure pursuit of theory? Like, you know, like just for example, domains like interpretability, it requires in its own charter of like going into the mathematics and how to trace back those things, versus a lot of good papers come out of applications, right? Like just solving a particular task, like for example self-supervised learning, that came out of a particular idea. So how have you seen an overall, what does the idea motivate to researchers, like big name researchers who have been doing some very influential works? Is it theory versus application?
I don't think it's that clear cut. Project to project varies, person to person varies. There are folks who really believe in a particular idea, and so everything that they do is going to be revolved around that particular idea. There are folks who are really driven by one particular application, and that's what they want to achieve. And that application, of course, is a moving target. So, you know, suppose someone wants to have like, okay, I want to really have a system that can confidently recognize whatever 500 different types of visual concepts. And that target will keep changing. And what it means to recognize these concepts also keeps changing. So I would say it's like driven by both things. It's driven by what capabilities they want. It's driven by also like their own core belief or their core sort of, you know, insight or stubbornness about what they really believe in. And yes, at times it's also building upon, hey, I don't understand this. And we kind of observed this. So let's just try to understand this a little bit more. And it may not be related to any downstream application. It just might be, you know, just like pure curiosity. Why is this supposed to happen? I can't explain it. And I mean, this is just for like my area of research, which would be computer vision, which is in general fairly empirical. I think like theoretical machine learners and in general, like other areas of machine learning operate fairly differently. I don't know much about how exactly they, and I actually marvel at how they are able to do their sort of research, because I have always operated in a very empirical way.
The same curiosity strikes me too. Most of the professors that I have been following since a very long time, most of the papers are much more oriented to a data set or a kind of a goal of beating the state of art or leaderboard positions. But often once in a very few years, papers come out that really change it from a very theoretical perspective, like 2012 or 2018 in the BERT and a few other papers. But yeah, that makes sense. I guess to me, I have seen, honestly, it's more of a combination, right? Oftentimes it's like the application triggers the theory, and hence theory further improves the application. But of course, that's one in random, like one in 100 professors that who actually try to do that, or researchers. But yeah. And if I were to try to zoom out a bit, maybe on you, and look at your perspective, is how has your work, or how has your perspective as a researcher, if we forget whatever position you are as a researcher, what are the key unique things that you have learned that was different from you being a PhD student at Carnegie Mellon versus being a research scientist at Facebook? Like, what are the few things that you picked up as a student, or just as a learner, that you learned that was only unique to maybe being a PhD student versus that is really unique to being a research scientist at Facebook?
I think like I can talk about commonalities and maybe then differences. So commonalities is like, I think in general, like you kind of need to accept failure. That's like the one thing. Failure is a part of this process. Failure is always going to be there. And you just need to understand how many times you fail. And every time that you fail, you need to understand, okay, this is going to happen. And how do you sort of move on from there? I think that sort of has not changed. And maybe it changes for other people. For me personally, I haven't seen that. I think the one thing that does change from being a student versus like working in industry is you get to see things change dramatically on like scale. So when I talk about scale, it's the scale at which a problem is tackled. So in terms of how many people think about it, the different perspectives they bring to that particular problem. The different sort of ideas, ways of thinking about it, that's actually like a big learning experience. I think as a PhD student, the circle in which you sort of discuss things for your particular project is relatively small compared to an industry where you actually get, or at least in my case, it is that you get access to a slightly larger group of people who are working on it. And people will work in very, very different styles. So that's actually kind of good to see. That's one of the things that dramatically changes. Then I think the other thing that as you sort of move, I guess, from being student to or like in more and more years, you kind of start developing like a, I would say, gut feeling about things that you want to do, or like your interest becomes more and more honed, because initially everything seems like, oh, you know, this is great. What do I work on? And I'm not saying now I don't think, I still think that way. But I still like, I think this is great. But I think I still want to do this. And, you know, that sort of, that feeling, at least for me, did not exist earlier. Because earlier I used to be like, huh, all these things are great, what to do now? And then I would like basically just like pick something with different factors. So the deliberation in the decision process, like now it becomes slightly more deliberate, may not be explainable to you. So I can't tell you why I picked a particular project, but at least it's more deliberate for me that I am kind of deciding to do a particular thing. And I think maybe gut feeling, I don't know how to say it, but that kind of developed for me.
Right. So I don't know if I should be happy or sad about this, because like you said, it's kind of the first case that you said that kind of resonates with me a lot. I like this, but I still want to work on that. And hence what I eventually end up doing is maybe try to connect all these things that I like versus to the point that I want to be at. Like I want to solve that particular question, but I find equally other questions relating to that. For example, like you said, supervised learning in itself, what the input versus output looks like, it could be related to somewhat along the GANs classification, like GANs, how GANs operate. They have this unique ability that you can provide it unannotated labels, and even then it can perform well on labeled data sets. And if you see the same cohort, it would look kind of similar to self-supervised learning, to where you take advantage of unlabeled or mixed bag of labels. So, but at the end, it's hard to make a decision, because you really like, I mean, GANs are good, self-supervised learning is good, but the way they operate is really different. But how do we decide? So yeah, that is kind of the stage, like you said. But one thing I would agree is I don't have that much strength of a gut feeling right now. I guess the weakness on in terms of gut feeling is much more profound in me right now. But
I mean, I don't think it's necessarily like, I'm not saying the gut feeling is right. It's just that you kind of get tired of like thinking about or taking so many decisions, so you decide to go with it. So gut feeling can actually be two ways, right? It can just be because of tiredness of like having so many options, and then just deciding, you know what, I'm tired, I'm just going to do this one particular thing. So that might be actually the reason for the gut feeling to develop as you progress, not necessarily like wisdom or anything else. I think the other thing that also happens, like what I talk about failure, right? Like failure sort of being a continual part of the process. I think I don't know, for me, what seemed to happen a lot more is earlier when I used to have a lot of these things, it was harder for me to understand what is really going on. And because, you know, I didn't know lots of things, and like lots of things go wrong. And now also I don't know lots of things, and still lots of things go wrong. But I think the ability to ask small questions, and that actually I think is very important, and that sort of also develops a little bit, like fairly small and simple questions. It often turns out that basically simple and small questions do reveal the most like surprising or the most relevant answers to things.
Right. So yeah, I guess if I were to visualize that feeling, it would, what one of my advisors said a couple of months back was like, you need to maximize out and to see overall perspective on the project. Because I think as a student, we get too much involved into the nitty gritty details of being too much technical versus also trying to make a good publication and also trying to make a novel contribution, solving these things. But at the end, you cannot have all the ways along, like you cannot hit all the milestones and also do the end thing. So yeah. I guess that's maybe a kind of a visualization of what you are saying. So,
yeah. And I think like one rule that I followed more and more is basically, can I explain whatever I'm doing in 3 minutes? If I cannot explain it in 3 minutes, then basically probably what I'm doing is too complicated, and it needs to be sectioned out into things. This is my way of operating. Of course, it's not the right way for everyone, but this is something I follow a little bit, try to at least as much as possible that in 3 minutes or so, I should be able to explain what I'm doing.
Yeah. The Richard Feynman technique, like if you can't explain it to a 5-year-old, you don't know it enough. So yeah,
exactly.
That makes sense. And so this brings me to one other question along the same line is, what is one thing you would suggest or advise someone who is trying to be a research, like who is trying to be a research scientist at any other job post, not necessarily Facebook, but what really was something that was uncalled for that you didn't knew, but of course you learned along the way that you didn't know? Of course, like you liked research, you liked exploring, but being a research scientist brought some XYZ topics that you didn't know were in the first place. But maybe, like you said, in your process of improving gut feeling, you also developed those skills. What was something that people should know, a heads up on being a research scientist at any big corporation?
I mean, I don't think necessarily research scientist is a big corporation. I'm not sure what that entails. And I think one skill that I underestimated, and I've seen a lot of folks underestimate, is how to write. And I think writing as a PhD student for me used to be like, okay, experiments matter the most. Writing, you know, whatever I have like 1 week, of course I could write it out when at night and like whatever. And my advisor kept telling me for the longest time, and I wasn't very convinced by it, that writing is actually very important. And that shouldn't be something that you do when you're super tired. Like I used to think, you know, coding is something I should do when I'm like, you know, super focused and then, you know, when I'm kind of sleepy or tired, that's when I basically should get to my paper, open LaTeX and start typing. I think it's actually, I would say slightly reverse. Writing is really important. And more I find that when I'm writing, I actually am able to think about things better, like organize my own thoughts better, plan my own thoughts better. And I think that's like one thing I had not imagined actually makes that much of a difference.
That's kind of a self-reflection, I guess, because for me, it's after 5 p.m. It's the time I typically work on my manuscripts that are in the draft phase. So I guess I should take a word of advice from that.
Yeah, I mean, I was told this advice multiple times by multiple like super smart people, but somehow I never really believed it. And you know, you are skeptical about it or whatever. There wasn't enough time to experiment and figure out if this is the right thing. But more recently, I think this is what actually, I agree with it. It took me a really long time to understand this is working.
Yeah, maybe I'll use that as a pretext for my models for sure. But apart from your research domain that is strictly along the lines of self-supervised learning or computer vision itself, what is one research domain that even if you are not directly working on it, that you are maybe exploring and really optimistic, as in you're trying to follow that research and see how it goes? Is there something apart from your research umbrella that you like to keep your bookmark on?
Like to, yes. Successful at, no. So I will just say like to. So I think there are like... the sort of more recent models that are being trained at the intersection of machine learning and biology, I think those are like super, super cool. Like what you're seeing in terms of projects coming out from say Facebook or DeepMind for like protein folding and essentially like, you know, being able to predict structures of proteins. I think that's really, really cool. And possibly I don't like, there are so many implications of it in the way how it can actually help us understand things better or do like larger scale experiments or faster experiments. I think that's something I'm super, super excited about. And I would really love to see, you know, what comes out of it. I'm directly not doing any of it. And also like, I don't think I'm following as much of it as I should, but I really like that area of research. And the other, which again, I'm not following at all and probably I should, is like quantum computing, which is not necessarily related to machine learning, but I'm still curious. Like now there are like folks are making a lot of progress on it, and I'm not first, I don't understand it well enough, but second is I should probably try to understand it and see what implications it has for the future.
Right. So I guess you completed the biggest triangle of deep learning, I guess. You are working at Facebook versus someone who is in healthcare plus AI, which is kind of Microsoft, and quantum plus deep learning, which is Google. So I guess you completed your triangle of interest. That makes sense. And in terms of like going back, just one last question that I have is, and maybe most of the people who are watching this or listening to this podcast are students, and they are maybe graduate researchers or doing their masters, is if I were to ask the previous question from a different angle, is what is one piece of advice that you would give to any person who is maybe interested into machine learning, the phase that you said, right? Like that always comes a phase where you are really motivated by machine learning by its glamorous structure, but of course a lot goes behind the hood that you would have learned, and like intense amount of failures in terms of implementations. I'm not talking about even writing papers and getting published, but trying to learn these skills. So what is one piece of advice that you would give to potential ML machine learning research students that you would say versus like what you were like, what you would give your advice to your other 2012 self, like 2012 student version that you wished you would have known?
That you're going to fail. That's going to happen. But really try to understand, like basically you're going to spend lots of time finding silly bugs and lots of time, like basically like finding sort of silly things in your code, or like really understanding very, very small nitty-gritties. I think that's really important because one, that actually helps you like basically get your hands dirty and figure out what like what is really happening at the sort of, you know, matrix operation level. Why is this gradient not right? So, you know, just like try to derive it yourself, try to figure out, okay, when given this input, what should be the gradient, and then look at the gradient and it's not the same. Why is it not the same? So basically trying to get into such a habit helps you understand like how these blocks come together. And especially when you're starting out, I think that's super, super valuable. So like when I started out, we didn't have automatic differentiation. So we would actually like, this is how we used to write like, you know, backwards passes, and they really like derive it on paper and then code it up. And I think that really helps because a lot of the times, you know, there were lots of silly assumptions that I had in my mind. Like, things weren't clear how it happens. You know, you just see the paper and you want like see how people have done it, but you don't really, really understand what's going on. Right. And I think that's pretty important to see. Get your hands dirty and basically figure out how it is. And you're going to fail at it lots of times, and that's fine. Everyone does.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a nice thing. Yeah. Even I would agree to a certain part of those advices, because it's kind of underrated or overrated at times about the parts of theory versus practice. And as a researcher, or maybe just like a student who is working along these research, you really need, at least in your initial stage of research, you need to have your hands dirty into both of these things. Having improper amount of theoretical knowledge is definitely backfires a lot. So yeah, definitely.
I mean, also like maths, I think like underestimating how the importance of like a good linear algebra course or a good linear algebra textbook. I think that's like, that's something we should not do. So like invest in a good linear algebra, like sort of understanding.
Yeah. Totally agree to that. But that were all the questions I had for you. I think we got to cover all of them. But I really found this one to be interesting because, like I said, I have been following your work and your group's work since quite a long time. So definitely it feels good to talk about those behind the scenes kind of mentalities while you are working on those papers. So it was fun, and I hope people who are listening to this podcast, they find this useful. I'll leave your website in the description below so that people who have any kind of genuine concern can maybe reach out to you. And but apart from that, again, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's fun. Thank you.